who worked at the Village Voice for 37 years and continues to report. Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to him last week at his home, where he's largely been confined due to his battle with lung cancer. Wayne Barrett's biography of Trump was just republished as an ebook. It's titled Trump, the Greatest Show on Earth, The Deals, The Downfall, The Reinvention. Visit our website at democracynow.org to watch, listen to, or read part one of our interview with Wayne Barrett that we ran last week. We have several job openings, a news producer and a senior video news producer, as well as an office coordinator. They're all full-time jobs based here in New York City. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prove, Ariel Boone, Vestica Dars. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
Join us Sunday night, July 10th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Soul Music and Politics. We will celebrate the life and music of Mr. Donny Hathaway. We will also deconstruct the at-large voting process in Multnomah County and Portland, Oregon, that keeps the status quo power elite in power. Sunday night for Soul Music and Politics, July 10th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. on KBOO.
Keep on walking tall. Hold your head up high.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow Intertribal Film Festival 2016, bringing Native American and Indigenous independent film to Portland, Oregon, July 28th through the 31st. Opening night at Clinton Street Theater with showings through the weekend at Hollywood Theater and Rainmaker Gallery. Please consider supporting independent media. More information can be found at oneflamingarrow.com.
The time is 5:01 and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next is the evening news.
The KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland voters will get to vote on an affordable housing measure.
Vancouver, Washington celebrates Pride.
And Free Speech Radio News brings us coverage from the bombings in Baghdad. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 5th, 2016. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. An affordable housing bond measure will go before voters in Portland this November. It was voted forward by the Portland City Council last week and has been billed as a big step forward in tackling the city's housing emergency. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Last Thursday, about 150 people attended a public hearing at Portland City Hall to weigh in on a proposed affordable housing bond measure. The council voted at the end to refer the measure to voters on the November ballot. It would raise about $258 million to pay for around 1,300 units of affordable housing in Portland, on top of a construction excise tax passed on Wednesday that will raise $12 million for affordable housing from new developments. The crowd overwhelmingly supported the housing bond, which was presented by Commissioner Dan Saltzman. Many of those who testified represented housing advocacy organizations like Street Roots, Home Forward, Community Warehouse, and the Welcome Home Coalition, among others. Some were people who had struggled with homelessness and housing insecurity themselves.
My name is Richard Edwards. A few years back, we were homeless. We slept in the car. The reason why we were homeless is because basically, our landlord had failed to tell us that his house was foreclosed on, and it was just a big shock. I was working in OSHU at the hospital, making real good money, paying my rent, had everything together, and this happened. Join made it possible for us to go to Stephen Creek's Crossing, which is a home forward property. And that is a blessing. I'm just so happy that my kids are safe right now. Really. I just want to thank everyone for doing their part. There's still a lot of families out there, and they need help. It was very scary for my family and us. And I just want to thank y'all.
And this is Maggie Dietz, a grandmother who testified to the difference that affordable housing programs made in her life.
During the boys' younger years, I was grandma in the open arms and the running. And, you know, they turn into teenagers and that kind of tames down. I'm celebrated a little more quietly now. But the fact remains that since I have an affordable place to live, I can spend time with them. We are close. We might not have been had I ended up living under a bridge, you know? I mean, who's to say? I can't tell you how passionately I wish that housing that makes sense for low-income people, individuals and families, were more readily available. It can and it does change lives.
While much of the hearing felt like a bit of a love fest for the city council, from housing advocates glad to see action on affordable housing, others like Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri gently pointed out that it was only the tip of the iceberg when it came to Portland's housing crisis.
I want to say thank you. You have been asked to do a lot, and you have done a lot, but we're not done yet. We still have thousands of people in our community who don't earn enough to pay the exorbitant amounts that new apartments cost.
Others were less gentle.
I'm here to voice my strong and unequivocal support for referring the Affordable Housing General Obligation bond measure to the November ballot. However, I'm not here to join in the back padding for your courage and leadership. This bond is a much needed step in the right direction. It's about a generation too late. It is the absolute least we can do and requires very little beyond this vote from City Council. It's the Voters and Welcome Home Coalition that will have to do the extremely hard work of getting it passed. Where is City Council's courage in declaring an emergency and instituting a rent freeze? Where is your leadership on overturning the ban on rent control?
That was Margot Black, an organizer with the group Portland Tenants United, a group that advocates for renters' rights. I spoke with her on Friday for more on how the city has treated the renting side of the housing crisis. The city last year passed this declaration of a housing emergency in Portland. Mm-hmm. How would you say that the city views tenants' rights in that context?
I would say that the energy around the housing emergency has almost completely been devoted toward both our very present and growing homelessness population and the supply side of the solution. The way that the city has largely tried to address it is both by creating more shelter beds. They have, you know, made some loosened some restrictions on camping, and I think all of that is, you know, good work that they have allowed these organized camps like Hazelnut Grove and Forgotten Realms to exist, and are certainly, you know, doing everything they can to create more housing for low income individuals, and all of that is really good and really important. It is not addressing why people are becoming homeless. Certainly, there are some systematic issues like, you know, drug abuse and addiction and mental illness and things like that. But then there are the homeless folks who've become homeless through rent increases and through no-cause evictions, or even for-cause evictions. You know, they may have been evicted because, say, their rent is too high, or other issues like that. But once you become homeless, it's incredibly hard to transition out of that in our current climate with a low vacancy rate.
In general, what obstacles are there in the city in the way of renter protections?
I think there are two major obstacles. One is that residential landlord-tenant law is mostly at the hands of the state. And for a very long time, local jurisdictions have just said, no, we can't do anything about it. You got to take it to the state. Whether it's at the state or at the city level at this point, the other big hurdle is basically special interests and big money. I mean, it's not just landlords who have an interest in this being as much free market capitalism as possible. It's realtors, it's developers, it's home builders. Because after the Wall Street and the financial industry
you know, crashed the economy back in 2008 and we stopped lending money to people to buy homes, well, first of all, those folks who lost their homes became renters. And big companies swept in and scooped up all those properties and now rent them out. And like my landlord is an asset management firm in Ohio, for example. And they use these analytical and statistical models to figure out, you know, basically exactly how much rent to charge in order to keep their vacancy rates at a certain level. And they have it down to a very good business. So politicians are scared of the backlash. I mean, raising revenue for affordable housing, especially by taxing the residents of Portland, is a pretty easy ask for those policymakers, right? You know, the voters get to decide. So the policymakers don't really have to be held accountable for a tax that passes or doesn't. I mean, they may get a little egg on their face if the tax passes and there are some very outspoken wealthy special interests against it. But for the most part, it's not standing up to big business. That is our biggest obstacle right now, is big real estate, if you will.
Margo Black with Portland Tenants United, thank mm-hmm. you very much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The fight for water is back in the news here in Oregon. A group of farmers from Umatilla County have filed complaints against the Westland Irrigation District and the Oregon Water Resources Department. Their complaint alleges that the Westland Irrigation District failed to deliver pre-allocated water to 10 smaller farms with senior water rights. Instead, the Irrigation District allegedly diverted that water to 3 larger farms with lesser water rights. The complaint against the Oregon Water Resources Department claims that the department has failed to enforce the plaintiff's right, in addition to ignoring the allegedly illegal actions by the Westland Irrigation District. A plaintiff in the case has said that she filed the complaint in order to help protect senior water rights. A special executive session was held today to talk about the litigation by the Westland Irrigation District in Echo, Oregon.
What do pedestrian safety, affordable housing, and taiko drumming have to do with one another? To highlight the ever-changing neighborhoods, KBOO News reporter Jemani Ward-Lewis spoke with Tony Tabor-Roberts about the local taiko drumming group, Unit Sozu. The group is offering a free workshop exploring pedestrian safety, transit, neighborhoods, and community identity through taiko Japanese drumming, theater, and discussion.
My project is in partnership with Unit Sozo, which is taiko group, which is Japanese drumming, and I'm a theater artist, and we have created this placemaking project that's part of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon's Jade and Midway Placemaking Project program this year, which is designed to engage the community and especially residents of those East Portland communities of the Jade and Midway District in discussions around neighborhoods, identity, pedestrian safety. There's been a proposed rapid transit to the area. This is an East Portland division in 82nd and then further east. So there's a rapid transit that was proposed for that area, which is going to really change the neighborhood. So we wanted to use theater and drumming to kind of help the community to talk about these issues, about how we can make ourselves safe and visible in our communities and use our voices.
Nice. So when will it be?
So we're holding a workshop on Saturday, July 9th at 1:00 in the afternoon, and it's going to take place at the Jade Apano Multicultural Space at 82nd and Division. It's in this old furniture store building across from PCC. And so we're going to have a community workshop. It's open to families and individuals for ages 8, 9, and above. And then we're going to take what we learn through these workshops and create a short piece that we'll be presenting in the public later on this summer.
All right. So what will people be expecting to do at the workshops?
At the workshop, I think people can expect that they would get to play games and have fun and then like bang on some drums and kind of learn to create some pieces and using their voices and also their bodies. So it should be a pretty fun, physical, and active workshop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I think I could mention also that we're one of a bunch of projects that were funded through the Apano Jade Midway Placemaking Projects. And so we're really proud to be part of this group of artists that are looking at how to engage people through arts and culture around these issues about displacement and neighborhood safety, et cetera.
Why is it important that you're doing this right now?
Yeah, you know, I think Portland is so quickly changing, and with housing affordability and space affordability and displacement, you know, such a one of the top crises of the community in Portland. I think we're trying to find, there's a lot of people doing a lot of awesome work on sort of policy level and also on grassroots level. But we wanted, I think, through these projects, and I think Apana's leadership is really looking at how we can engage people on more of a emotional and a heart level through arts and culture work. And so I think that's the goal of a lot of these projects, including ours. There's also been like poetry and writing projects. There's another theater project that is looking really at sort of the transit aspect of this. There's a comic book that someone else is writing. So I think just really trying to reach maybe community members who might not even realize some of these larger issues that are happening, but that seem sort of like, oh, there's all these politicians talking about it, but this is a way that we can get community stories on the ground.
Is there anything else you feel is important for the listeners?
I think we're excited to talk to community members and for them to participate, and we hope that this is a fun way to, you know, it's a pretty serious topic, but I think there is a fun aspect to it to really be more of an empowering kind of way of looking at the issues. So that's what we hope to bring to this project.
Great. Well, this is Tony Tabora Roberts with Unit Sozu.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for talking.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Jemani Ward-Lewis.
Celebrations for Pride are still happening here in the Pacific Northwest. In Vancouver, Washington, Saturday in the Park Pride will be taking place this weekend. Saturday in the Park Pride is a group dedicated to providing educational, scholarship opportunities, and support services for the LGBTQ families, children, and friends in the greater Clark County area in Washington State. To find out more about this event, KBOO News spoke with Saturday in the Park Pride organizer Michael McCutcheon.
This coming Saturday, we have a huge lineup. We've got Lyle's Miles 5K race, which starts at 7:30 in the morning. That raises funds for HIV/AIDS awareness, both locally and globally. Then at 11, we have the Pride Festival. There will be several politicos there and many, many booths, including a major change for us, which means that the City of Vancouver's Police Department will actually be there recruiting.
What made you decide to invite the police department over to recruit at Pride?
We called them because the city was having some questions around what happened in Orlando, what happened in Los Angeles, and the fact that we do not have fences up. We are completely open. The event itself brings in a good 300 to 400 children. So their security question came up with, you know, what are you guys going to do? Are you looking at anything different? And I called the police and had a conversation with several departments, the diversity committee, the chief of police, the chief of the lieutenant in charge of the precinct, and then finally got the lieutenant in charge of recruitment. And he has volunteered to bring his recruitment booth and show that we have a vested interest from the city to really recruit into a diverse group, including lesbian, gays, bisexuals, and transgendered people.
What else is going to be new at Vancouver Pride this year?
We have Son de Cuba. It is a salsa band, which is absolutely amazing. If you love dancing and you love dancing out in the middle of a park, this is the perfect shot for you. We have clowns. We have contortionists. We have comedians. We have pretty much the gamut of anything you can imagine entertainment-wise for an entire day. And any child who comes, there's going to be 200 balloons around the park, free to grab and free to take home.
Michael, all over the world this year, there are new issues around Pride, as you already referred to, the concerns that the Vancouver Police Department had. What themes do you see your community bringing out this year? Are there certain issues, ideas, or concepts that you think are really big in the celebration you're planning this weekend?
Well, the biggest fear for us is a rainstorm coming in. That's the most energy anyone's putting forward right now. But as a community, we are doing a lot more outreach. We will have booths there referencing issues around safe lives, safe neighborhoods, safe choices. We have the domestic violence people. They're going to be there offering services and information. We have medical personnel who will be offering information. We have lots of support services, informationals, churches. We have 8 churches in the area who show up every year and work with people around concerns and issues. Last year, out of the blue, we did have someone who was looking rather depressed and was considering taking his own life. And it was a big boon to have this, all the support services right there and talking to someone about how we can make a change in your life and make a better decision than ending it.
So how do people get involved with Vancouver Pride? And let us know how to contact you. And one more time, where we're going and when.
Okay, so it's this Saturday. It will be all day at Esther Short Park, which is in downtown Vancouver. If you're going I-5 South or I-5 North, you're going to be taking the same exit, which is Mill Plain. And then you just follow the signs to downtown Vancouver, which is basically at 6th Street and Washington. If you're familiar with the Vancouver Farmers Market, we're right next to them for the entire day. And then the evening time, there's also at the Eagles Airy, there will be the Mr., Miss., and Ms. Gay Vancouver pageant. So it's going to be a full day of fun. We do have a website, which is sitppride.org, which stands for Saturday in the Park. Pride.org. All the information, phone numbers, email addresses are right there. You can get a hold of anyone anytime.
Michael McCutcheon, Vancouver Pride. Thanks a lot for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. We really appreciate it.
And have a fabulous weekend.
And you too, come join us. It's a free event and open to all.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news in depth for an interview about the affordable housing ballot measure at 5:45, followed by Trans Positive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Willamette Valley is looking a bit wet, so get ready for some light showers in the afternoon and evening with a high of 77 and a low of 58. East of the Cascades and Hood River, skies will be sunny with a high of 78 and also a low of 58. Today in history, in 1937, the Hormel Food Corporation introduced Spam, the popular canned meat known for its signature blue can. Over 7 billion cans of the pink meat have been sold and can be bought in 41 countries around the world. For all you Spam fans out there, you can learn more about it by visiting the Spam Museum in Austin, Minnesota. The quote of the day is from Microsoft founder Bill Gates, who said, quote, "I get more spam than anyone I know."
It is 5:22. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Tony Blair, Britain's former prime minister, has lashed out at British voters for having, quote, "a shared hostility to globalization," referring to their June 23rd decision to exit the European Union. A decade ago, PM Blair had backed expansion of EU's power over the citizens of Great Britain and 27 other European nations, so he took the Brits' recent rejection personally. In a New York Times op-ed, he rather prissily blamed the Brexit vote on populist demagogues who had caused, quote, "palpitations in the body politic." Obviously befuddled, he asked, "How did this happen?" Well, sir, one reason is that you and other peers of Britain's privileged class long ago imposed policies that reduced the wealth and opportunities of common wage earners while greatly increasing the wealth and power of corporate executives and rich investors. Indeed, your prized European Union has become a messy, bureaucratic, multinational government of, by, and for corporate interests over common people. Located in faraway Brussels, EU officials make decisions that harm British working stiffs who never heard of the decision makers and have no power to replace them or to alter the decisions. That, Your Highness, is how and why the Brexit rejection of European government happened. It was a democratic shout of anger at the usurpation of the people's sovereignty and well-being by you and your fellow architects of corporate plutocracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the obtuse, self-absorbed Tony Blairs of our world still don't get it. He concluded his op-ed by pleading with establishment centrists to regain political control from the people and, quote, find solutions that rise above populist anger. Exactly wrong, sir. The obvious solution is to understand and work with the angry populace rather than stoking their anger with more solutions raining down on them.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
For the first time in 30 years, policies that drive federal leasing of coal on public lands are receiving a major review. The nation's largest coal reserve in Wyoming's Powder River Basin are the biggest beneficiaries of this program. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell suspended new leasing earlier this year and ordered the Bureau of Land Management to hold public hearings that take into account the economic, environmental, and social cost of the program. FSRN's Martha Baskin has our story.
From ranchers in Wyoming to representatives of tribes from all over the West to county executives in cities like Seattle, a wide array of people are taking the opportunity to weigh in on the federal government's coal leasing program. They are grappling with questions like, what are the consequences of burning what James Hansen has long called the most carbon-intense fossil fuel? What is a fair return for communities who mine coal and those affected by the cost to public health and rail transport? Should taxpayers pay coal companies? Northern Cheyenne tribal member Caden Walksnice testified at one recent hearing in downtown Seattle. He'd just come from fighting wildfires in Colorado earlier that day.
My crew understands how much this hearing means to me and how much I care about for my people. Anything that the BLM does with coal development affects my people.
Ancestral Cheyenne territory encompasses some 80% of what is now the Powder River Coal Basin in southeast Montana and northeast Wyoming. The region holds 40% of all the nation's coal reserves, which account for an estimated 13% of all U.S. greenhouse gases. Walksnice told the Bureau of Land Management he'd witnessed firsthand an increase in fire activity since 2012.
One of the wildfires actually started on BLM land near a coal mine north of our community. And we've lost some houses in that fire. We lost power. It was a scary moment for our elders because our elders' complex was north of town where the fire was coming.
Walksnice, whose Cheyenne name is 20 Stands, pauses. Nearly 300,000 acres were burned. A transition to renewables, he says, is overdue. Solar systems have already been installed on elders' homes on the reservation. But rancher Ogden Driscoll with the Bear Lodge Cattle Company says BLM policies of leasing what was once wild public lands to coal companies have been good for Wyoming and good for ratepayers. Driscoll's family drove cattle from Texas to Wyoming in the 1860s and have been there ever since. In the past decade, BLM-managed lands produced some 4.3 billion of coal that the agency says produced 6.8 billion in royalties and 3.8 billion in rents, bonuses, and other payments. Driscoll says 2,000 new power plants going up around the world will burn what he calls dirty, nasty coal unless they have access to Powder River Basin coal.
If you want them not to pollute our air, what it truly is a worldwide environment, we really ought to be burning Powder River Basin coal in those plants because that will change the impacts they're talking about on climate change and the environment, if we're going to be honest about it.
Driscoll and others in the Wyoming delegation who favor the federal leasing program say coal from Powder River Basin is the cleanest coal in the world because of its low sulfur content. But the math isn't that simple. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, while Western coal may have less sulfur, it also has fewer BTUs of energy, or a lower heat rate. That means power plants need to burn 50% more Western coal to match the power output from Eastern coal. Earth Justice Attorney Jan Hasselman says a review of the BLM leasing program should have happened a long time ago when awareness of coal's environmental impact first surfaced. Hasselman has represented communities fighting new coal terminals on the West Coast, such as the proposed Millennium Bulk Terminal's Longview Coal Export Project in Washington State. He says the coal leasing program amounts to a federal subsidy of a dangerous, poisonous substance.
We have an inconsistency between some of our goals, which involve dramatic reductions in greenhouse gas pollution, and some of the things that we do to effectively encourage or subsidize more oil, more gas, more coal.
Hasselman adds that the Obama administration's goals on climate don't address fossil fuels extracted from public lands. Meanwhile, King County Executive Dow Constantine of Seattle says the global climate challenge is extraordinarily urgent.
The local impacts of both coal and oil transport remain unaddressed. It is these tribal leaders, local government leaders, who are stuck with the burden of trying to protect their communities, even as the oil and coal companies are making money off of our public resources.
A Union Pacific oil train explosion in the small town of Mosier, Oregon, along the Columbia River earlier this summer, has many officials in the region calling for a moratorium on the trains. Oregon and Washington have been ground zero for transporting coal from Powder River Basin to the West Coast for years, a destination that, after last December's lifting of the export ban, now includes Asia. Critics of the BLM's coal leasing program on federal lands far outnumbered supporters at the Seattle hearing. The pause on new leases does not apply to those currently in force or to coal production activities. While the public hearings have finished, the Bureau of Land Management is accepting written comments until July 28th. The BLM plans to issue a report summarizing the public input by the end of the year. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
British citizens are waiting with bated breath for the release of a report tomorrow that aims to explain what went wrong with England's part in the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Residents of the United States are largely unaware that tomorrow, retired civil servant John Chilcott is expected to release the document, which was years in the making and weighs in at more than 2.5 million words. The report is expected to hit former Prime Minister Tony Blair especially hard. Blair pushed the U.K. to be one of former President George Bush's, quote, coalition of the willing, which was a handful of small countries that participated in the U.S. invasion. While the number of deaths is disputed, the U.S.-led conflict killed as many as 1 million Iraqis, 179 British troops, and more than 4,500 American troops. It also has contributed to a suicide rate among U.S. troops that averages 22 deaths per day, according to U.S. military officials.
The number of people killed in a massive explosion and fire in Baghdad continues to climb almost 2 days after a suicide bomb attack in a crowded shopping area. Amnesty International is calling for restraint after Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi pledged to speed up executions of convicted terrorists already on death row in the country. Monday, rescue workers remain at the scene, families begin to bury their dead, and the nation is observing 3 days of mourning. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Iraqi Christians joined Muslim mourners praying for the victims of the blast as the death toll rose above 200 Monday. Many children are reportedly among the dead, and hundreds of people are injured. Rescue workers were still finding bodies in the charred remains of the Karada shopping district after the massive weekend explosion in the predominantly Shia Muslim area of Baghdad. With dozens of bodies burnt beyond recognition, many families are left desperately hoping, yet deeply afraid. The attack came on the eve of Eid al-Fitr, and the Karada district was packed with people celebrating Ramadan and preparing for the festival that brings the Muslim holy month to a close. The self-proclaimed Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the blast. The explosion was triggered by a refrigerated truck packed with explosives, which sparked an enormous fire in the area filled with well-stocked shops selling goods for the upcoming holiday. Mohammed Al-Bayd is vice chair of Baghdad Community Security. Distraught, he spoke to CCTV in the aftermath of the blast.
Most of the people in the building were in their 20s. Now hundreds of people have been hurt here. The government sits on a chair doing nothing when it comes to security.
Security services in Baghdad are fractured into small agencies, and many say they are ineffective. The attack comes just more than a week after U.S.-backed Iraqi forces reclaimed nearby Fallujah from the self-styled Islamic State. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi visited the scene of the attack Sunday, but was met by hostile crowds who hurled rocks and bottles as he walked through the fire-ravaged area, angry at an ineffective government they say has failed to protect them. The Qurrata blast wasn't the only attack for which ISIS has claimed credit in recent days. In Bangladesh, seven attackers launched a siege late Friday night at an upscale international restaurant in the capital, Dhaka. The perpetrators targeted foreigners, butchering 20 people with machetes before police stormed the building. Sunday, officials identified the attackers. All were well-educated members of the Bangladesh elite. Police killed all but one at the end of the siege. One attacker is in custody. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
Now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. For some time now, I've been thinking about how obscure the whole concept is of corporations being able to exercise their constitutional rights. I'm a full-time educator in this work, so it's not obscure to me, but for most Americans, including most activists, corporate constitutional rights is a concept that is only vaguely understood. I can open the daily newspaper in any city on any given day, and I know how to read between the lines. Corporate rights are hidden in plain sight in pretty much every news story that has anything to do with large corporations. If our news media dug a little deeper and exposed this hidden story on a regular basis, we the people would quickly learn that there's actually something that we can do to end corporate abuses of power and corporate interference in our political system if we work to dismantle these structures of law that make corporate harm not just legal and inevitable, but actually protected by our Constitution. The claim I'm making here is certainly true for our mainstream media, owned by giant corporations, but sadly, it's just as true for our own independent media, like Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, which misses golden opportunity after golden opportunity to unveil deeper truths in its reporting. Here are two examples of recent news stories that are ultimately about corporate rights, but you'd never know that unless you knew how to read between the lines, which we the people must begin to do if we're going to ever turn this mess around. Story number one. The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing a 1,000-fold increase in the amount of radioactivity allowed in drinking water under the Safe Drinking Water Act. The EPA proposal would permit radiation exposures equal to 250 chest x-rays per year. Yes, you heard me right. The EPA's proposed new rule would permit the nation's drinking water to contain enough radiation to dose you with the equivalent of 250 chest x-rays each year. Now, who could have dreamed up such a dangerous proposal? Let me guess. Was it the American people who are chomping at the bit to be ingesting 1,000 times the radiation they're currently ingesting? Probably not. Perhaps city councils are demanding higher levels of radiation in our drinking water. Not likely. Perhaps the nuclear power and nuclear weapons industry had a hand in this proposal. Of course they did, though the article never mentions which institutional culprits came up with this nonsense. There frankly is no other explanation for this story, but here's the kicker. If nuclear energy and nuclear weapons corporations had no access to this magic thing called constitutional rights, the EPA would never have proposed this in the first place. Because, you see, corporations need First Amendment free speech rights simply to participate in government rulemaking processes. Without access to the First Amendment granted to them by the Supreme Court, they would have no voice in the process at all, even behind the scenes. Shouldn't the public know this detail? Without this context, we're all left to believe that the EPA has just gone nuts and there's nothing we can do about it. Story number two. Oregon Governor Kate Brown is getting bolder by the day in her response to the oil train derailment and fire that could very well have burned down the entire town of Mosier in the Columbia Gorge in early June. But she's still only calling for a temporary moratorium on oil trains in the gorge until they can be made safe, which, by the way, they can't. The Mosier fire chief is calling for a total ban on oil trains in the gorge, and yet neither of them believes that the state or the town can pass a law that would ban these trains from entering the gorge. Why? Because federal preemption laws prohibit local and state governments from regulating or banning dangerous freight by rail, even where the public overwhelmingly supports such a ban, like in Mosier. That's usually where media ends the story, but this leaves out two critical pieces of information. First, that Governor Kate Brown and the Mosier City Council aren't allowed to pass bans on oil trains because the U.S. Supreme Court has granted greater constitutional rights to corporations than to we the people. Rail freight corporations exercise this right under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Thanks, Supreme Court. And second, we in the community rights movement are passing local laws that ban harmful corporate activities even when we're not allowed to pass such laws. Why? Because we strongly believe that state and federal preemption laws are a violation of we the people's right to govern ourselves. And in fact, Columbia County, Oregon is currently in the process of gathering signatures to place on the ballot a total ban on oil and coal trains passing through their county. So you see, it can be done. But only when we the people stop acting so obedient in the face of unjust laws. Just imagine what might change in the public's understanding of what is possible if our news media, including our own indie media, paid more attention to these deeper truths in their reporting. Perhaps most of us would feel less hopeless and powerless, and that would be a really good thing. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Portland artist and publicist Lisa Lapine has died from complications of cancer surgery. A tireless music and event promoter, Lisa helped dozens of musicians and vaudevillians start their careers in Portland metro area. As the news spread over social media today, many in Lapine's community credit her with nurturing some of the artists that originally made Portland weird. For many years, she worked as the booking agent for local cultural events and had a hand in genres from country to punk, pop, blues, and world music. Her family said of Lisa's passing, quote, "She left us gracefully, peacefully, and without pain." Friends and loved ones are gathering as we speak at the McMenamins Kennedy School on Northeast 33rd Avenue to play live music. The public is welcome. The event runs until 10 p.m. tonight.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jomani Ward-Lewis and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Daniel Parks and Patricia Kohlberg, also Wesley Seaway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Argonne National Lab scientist Dr. Seth Darling speaks on the end of water as we know it. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the bike show looks at the Tour de France with American cyclist Davis Finney and associate professor Christopher S. Thompson, author of The Tour de France, A Cultural History. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going out to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Kanan.
Good night, Jenna.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last Friday, the Portland City Council approved a ballot measure which, if approved by voters, would allow the city to use general obligation bonds to build affordable housing. Jess Larson is with the Welcome Home Coalition, the group behind the ballot measure. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Jess Larson to learn more.
Well, simply, the ballot measure will read, allows the city of Portland to use general obligation bonds to build affordable housing. And what that means is we're going to use a very common tool, general obligation bonds, that builds public infrastructure. We use general obligation bonds to build bridges, to build our roads, to build libraries, parks, schools. And now, for the first time, we're also going to use this tool to build another critical and sadly, tragically missing piece of our public infrastructure, which are affordable homes. We have many affordable homes, and the homes that we do have, we know work really great and change and save and stabilize the lives of the families who live in these homes. But we sadly have only one home for every two Portlanders who need an affordable home. And so this ballot measure is going to make a really big dent in building hundreds of homes for thousands of Portlanders who need them most.
Who will be paying for it?
So this will be a property tax mechanism, much like we are use our property taxes to build those streets, to build those libraries, to build those schools. We're going to be asking Portlanders to do their part to help build more affordable homes.
Okay, now here's the thing. If the ballot initiative passes,